It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we take a look at the crime duo that went viral with a selfie of sorts back in the 1930s.
First, Governor Scott Walker will give his sixth State of the State address tonight from the State Assembly chambers.
Since his time in office, the governor has pointed to a record of tax and spending cuts and conservative legislation he's signed into law, and he's won three elections for governor. But in November, he had only a 38% approval rating here in Wisconsin.
Jason Stein is with us now to preview the governor's address tonight. He's a state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can see his piece about tonight's State of the State address on the Central Time Facebook page. Jason, welcome back.
Thanks, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Well, what's at stake for Governor Walker during tonight's State of the State address after passed with very ambitious legislation and then a failed presidential bid?
So obviously, he's trying to regain the momentum he had as one of the most important political leaders in a generation in Wisconsin. I mean, he's obviously had a very significant impact on the state in his first 5 years in office, but he as well is facing what's clearly the most difficult time for him as a politician who's been in office for decades. So, you know, it's a chance to see how does he or does he not regain that initiative.
And Governor Walker's approval rating was down to 38% in November. Typically, would you expect to see a bounce after a successful State of the State address?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I guess what I would say is this year, or, you know, governors who run for president it's not necessarily kind to their approval ratings at home. They have to do a lot of traveling. They have to do a lot of fundraising. They have to put a lot of their focus outside their own state. Running for president's a full-time job. So, you know, I would expect there to be some gain for him, in a fairly growing economy now that he's able to refocus at home. But, you know, we haven't seen that so far.
And you wrote at one point that the buzz surrounding Governor Walker's last State of the State address is long gone. What do you mean by that? And if he's looking to move upward, what does he need to do tonight?
Well, obviously, a year ago, he was about to take off to near front runner status for the Republican nomination for president. Obviously, at this point, earlier today, he just sent out, yesterday, just sent out a fundraising appeal asking for money from supporters to help pay off more than $1 million in campaign debt that he has left over from that presidential race. So, I mean, obviously, things have changed significantly. Now, what he needs to do, I mean, politically, he needs to repair his campaign apparatus and get himself in a position where he might run for a third term. And from a policy standpoint, again, he's got to sort of regain that initiative that to a certain extent has gone to other lawmakers of his own party over the last year.
And let's talk policy a little bit, Jason. What are you going to be looking for tonight?
Well, he said that he will put forward plans to reduce student debt. They're not as big as what Democratic lawmakers would like to see. He'll put that forward. You know, I guess the big question will be, in the past, Governor Walker has put forward plans that literally affected hundreds of millions of dollars in public spending and public taxes. And, you know, are we going to see those sorts of sweeping proposals tonight, or are we going to see more modest ones like the student debt proposal that is about an $8 million proposal?
We're talking to Jason Stein right now, state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, getting a preview of tonight's State of the State address from Governor Walker. And Jason, you talked about how he's got a move back into a position where he's got some momentum behind him, working maybe with the legislature. But do you expect to see anything big and bold, like maybe Act 10?
We haven't seen any signs of legislation of that that sweep in tonight's in the previews of tonight's speech. He does have a bill to overhaul the civil service in Wisconsin. He's been pushing since shortly after stepping down from the presidential race. But again, you know, we haven't seen that. The state budget is pretty tight. So, you know, when you want to do something big, what you typically look for is some money in the bank. So that's obviously one of the challenges he has over the next year.
Now, Democratic leaders in the state legislature asked for Governor Walker to work with them on proposals that would restructure student loan debt and also expand broadband access in Wisconsin. Do you think it's likely that the governor is in a state of mind that he's interested in working across the aisle on propositions like those?
I think only to a very limited extent. I mean, obviously, by taking up the issue of student loan debt, that is certainly a nod to Democratic lawmakers and other activists who've been pushing this issue for a number of years. At the same time, they want to see broader proposals like creating a public authority, a state entity that would help student loan borrowers refinance their debt. You know, proposals including a tax deduction that would be larger than the one that the governor's proposing. So, you know, I mean, to the extent he's taking up the issue, you might say that he is stepping across the aisle a little bit. But that's it would be a small step compared to what Democrats had hoped.
What do you expect the governor to say about the state's economy?
Well, I mean, he's obviously... Typically, I've never heard a governor say anything but that the economy is doing well or at least doing better than the nation. You know, you can look to a lot of – there's certainly figures that he can point to. Our unemployment rate is below that of the national average. At the same time, in Wisconsin, our unemployment rate is typically below the national average as it is now. And in terms of job creation, we have lagged the rest of the nation over Governor Walker's term. So there's going to be numbers that he can point to, but there's also going to be numbers that his opponents will point to afterwards.
Now, as he gives the State of the State address tonight, who is his target audience? Is it those in the assembly chambers, or is it the public watching in Wisconsin?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it's obviously senators in the assembly, 132 lawmakers that are going to be out there in the audience, along with other state officials. But obviously, the hope is that he can gain an audience that's larger than that. And, you know, step into the spotlight a little bit where he, you know, really has not been since last fall.
Is that what you consider a key part of this, getting this momentum back, being in the spotlight? Does he just need to be more visible in a sense?
You know, I think it's not enough to be visible. I mean, I think he's got to be visible and outdoing, out-proposing. I mean, the power of a governor is to propose, to set the agenda, to always be one step ahead of his critics and also one step ahead of his supporters. I mean, you know, that's what leadership is. And, you know, the State of the State speech is a traditional venue for governors to exercise that leadership. So we'll see what the governor chooses to do with his speech in just a few hours.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Jason Stein, State Government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us there to talk about Governor Walker's State of the State address tonight. And you can hear that address on WPR as well as a live special in the state capitol hosted by Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg and WPR's Sean Johnson. That's tonight at 7 on WPR. As the saying goes, a picture is worth a thousand words, and that's doubly true for the infamous crime duo Bonnie and Clyde.
The bank robbers exploded into the national imagination after candid, even playful photographs of them ended up in newspapers around the world. Authorities found their undeveloped film at the scene of a crime. The pictures took on a life of their own. A new PBS documentary tells their story.
In a world where there was very little to get excited about in summer 1933, Bonnie and Clyde were pretty big news.
Everybody was talking about the criminals, the bad guys. But Clyde and Bonnie had the one thing the others didn't, the whole true romance and the sexy scandal.
The story of Bonnie and Clyde by American Experience broadcasts on your local public television station tonight at 8 o'clock. And joining us now to talk about their lives is Buddy Barrow, the nephew of Clyde Barrow. Buddy, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, ma'am.
Well, I want to hear in your words, how would you explain the appeal that Bonnie and Clyde had, why people were drawn to them despite this trail of crimes behind them?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with the Depression, how the banks were foreclosed, and a lot of people's property, you know, people that worked hard and When the banks failed, they just lost everything they had, their money and everything. They couldn't produce anything, you know, the farm. They couldn't get money to produce any crops or anything. So Clyde just, you know, hated the poverty part. And I guess society was really rooting them on because they were actually doing the banks were what was doing to them.
So the poverty aspect of both of their lives is something that seems like it threw them together early on. They both came from, just sounds like, utter poverty. How did that shape what they wanted to do and what they wanted for themselves?
Well, you know, even at the time, jobs were scarce, and Clyde's older brother, Buck, he was just a, what you call a huckster. He would go to these, like my grandfather, he would go to these job sites and clean up these different areas, you know, to construction sites. Once they got through, they wanted the area cleaned of all debris, you know, excess lumber, iron, whatever. And then I think Buck had got a hold of some copper, and I think there was a misunderstanding, and he took this copper. Of course, he had Clyde helping him, and next thing you know, this copper winds up being stolen, and these two boys are now, you know, headed for real bad trouble.
And part of the formative years of or experience of Clyde, he ended up in jail really early on. What happened to him when he was in jail?
Well, after he was sent to sent to Eastern Prison for him, of course, that was probably one of the most brutal penal systems as it was in the country. And of course, Clyde, being a little 19-year-old kid, he had no idea what he was, you know, going to be facing with it, some of these people in there, because they were hardened criminals, some of them pedophiles. And when you get a young kid in there, sometimes these guards were just as ruthless as the criminals themselves, and they'll turn a blind eye to some of these pedophiles. And then when Clyde was raped, apparently the guy picked the wrong guy to rape, and I think Clyde, took a piece of pipe and split the guy's skull. Of course, that was Clyde's first murder. Now this young boy has really seen some really bad things. He saw things that he couldn't imagine that another human being would do to another human being. And this changed Clyde dramatically. From that point on, he was, the family just, they didn't know what to expect from him.
And he got pardoned from that prison sentence. But as you said, it sounds like he left that experience thinking, as far as prison went, never, never again. And how did that inform what happened later?
Well, what happened when he came back to Dallas, law enforcement had a policy that if you were a known ex-con, they had a procedure where they would harass you to the point to make you move out of their jurisdiction. And when I say harass you, they'd pick you up just for anything. And Clyde would actually have a job, and he was trying to work and make a living. And if something happened, well, they knew where to find him. And West Dallas was full of some of these people who were just no matter what you did, you couldn't change the way they already changed their lives. So once they knew where Clyde was, they'd pick him up and take him downtown for questioning, see if he knew anything about these different crimes. Well, this went on and went on, and finally his employers would just let him go. They just couldn't have that going on. And no sooner than he'd be taken down for investigation, they let him out, and he'd be walking home, and another second detective would pick him up. Well, this went on to a point that he just told his mom. He said, the number going to let me be in peace. He says, I'll see him in hell. And when he struck out, he meant just that.
Now, you've got a unique position in all this as Clyde Barrow's nephew. Can you tell us a little bit about what Clyde and Bonnie were like?
Well, I never knew them. I mean, I knew all the rest of the Barrow family. And, of course, I know Bonnie's niece. They were all Christian people, and they hated to see what happened to those two kids, and once they got involved in something, he just went downhill from there. And then when Clyde committed his first murder, he knew he was a dead man. And they did everything they could to try to convince him to, surrender. And Clyde knew that once he killed that first guy that, there was no turning back. And Bonnie chose to stay with him when she was in a real bad car wreck and burnt to the point that you know, she couldn't hardly walk, couldn't really take care of herself, and Clyde nurtured her and, you know, and took care of her, and she saw that devotion in him, and she was willing to go to her death with him.
We're talking right now to Buddy Barrow, nephew of Clyde Barrow of the crime duo Bonnie and Clyde, and the story of Bonnie and Clyde by American Experience, broadcast tonight on public TV stations at 8 o'clock. And you said you didn't know Clyde Barrow, or Bonnie for that matter, but what did you hear at the family gatherings among your family? Were they thought of warmly? Did people really care about them, even though they had done all these terrible things?
Well, when I was growing up, this was a subject that the younger kids weren't allowed to listen to. I didn't really, I mean, I heard bits and parts, but as far as knowing everything, one time I had, we went over to my aunt's home, and of course I jumped out of the car and run in the house first. Well, my aunt was going through a bunch of photographs, and when I saw the photographs of the car, it was all shut up and all that stuff, and I was started asking questions. My dad just said, "Hey, boy, go outside and play. I'll talk to you later about this." You know, and that's the way it was until I became a teenager. And, of course, I had learned from the older kids asking questions, and I'd overheard some of the conversations that, you know, they were having with my grandfather and my aunts and all that. And so I just started putting two and two together, and then when I was probably about 11 or 12, my dad asked me if I wanted to go with him on some road trips because he was a truck driver. And it was during spring, you know, summer break. So we'd go all over the place, go up Arkansas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Missouri, Kansas. We'd go through some of these places where Clyde and Bonnie had actually, you know, been involved with some things there in those towns, and my dad would tell me some of the stories, and as long as I kept my mouth shut and didn't ask no questions, he'd just keep on talking. But once I asked a question, he'd just say, you know, I'm tired of talking about this, I don't want to talk about it no more. So I learned just to, you know, keep my ears open, my mouth shut.
Well, we got to talk about these pictures that they left behind, because they really changed everything in terms of the way the world saw them, brought the world in on their story. Tell us about these pictures that were left behind at a crime scene. I think it was in Joplin.
Right. These photographs were never, ever to reach the public's hand. What had happened, most of them, when they were out clowning around, they'd give the film to the family, and the family would have them developed and, you know, divide them between the family members. But there was actually film that was left in the Joplin house that, of course, there was a, you know, a marriage certificate and Clyde's parole papers, and then when they found the pictures of these people, now they know who they were. And once they knew who they were, of course, they sent all these photographs to different news media throughout the United States, and this is who they're looking for. And then another occasion happened in Dallas, just outside of Sowers, and there was three rolls of film left there, so they knew exactly who they were looking for. And once they had that, then, you know, their days were numbered.
And these pictures, at least the ones that really capture the public's imagination, they weren't typical pictures for the time, especially of Bonnie. You know, they showed her chomping on a cigar and holding a gun. How did that, do you think, go over at the time?
Well, I, you know, like I said, it was just like two kids clowning around, like, you know, some of the kids do, acting dumb, you know, and you got a weapon. And, of course, Bonnie hated the picture with her with the cigar, because now they started calling her cigar, smoking mall, and she hated that. And, like I said, once these photographs got out, you know, it was labeled. You know, like I said, their days were numbered once they knew these photographs were out.
And how do you think Americans felt when Bonnie and Clyde were killed, when their deaths, I mean, there are pictures of the funeral in this documentary, the thousands of people there. I mean, do you think there were mixed feelings about the end of Bonnie and Clyde?
Yeah, they had all these migrant farmers, and that were traveling place to place looking for work and this and that. Clyde and Bonnie would get in with these people and buy food from them, you know, and may stop at a door, knock on a door, and they could smell their beans or cooking, and they'd buy this stuff from them. And then once they saw what was actually taking place, you know, that why they were doing what they were doing, I guess it was like a soap opera. People were following every move they made, you know, just to see if they were going to get caught, when they were getting caught. because Clyde was probably one of the most elusive Depression outlaws there were. Once he started running, he wasn't caught until the day they killed him. So they were actually rooting for him.
Well, the documentary, it's so interesting to watch. It's hard to pull away from it, but this is a factual representation. How do you feel about the way Hollywood took on Bonnie and Clyde back in the 60s?
Yeah, we did. The family did everything we could to stop the 1967 film. My grandmother was arrested, I don't know how many times, when in 1934, because they were showing these documentaries at different theaters. She would go up to the theater, pull them billboards off and all the advertisement, and they arrested her and took her to jail for that. You know, she wasn't trying to publicize what Clyde and Bonnie did. I mean, it broke her heart to lose a child or two kids in the manner that they did. And she thought it was disgraceful that they would, you know, dramatize them so big whenever the family was heartbroken over what happened. And not only that, they felt sorry for the families that were involved.
Yeah, we got to leave
it there. Lost her family.
Buddy, thank you. Fascinating stuff. Thanks for joining us.
You're so welcome.
That was Buddy Barrow, nephew of Clyde Barrow. And the story of Bonnie and Clyde by American Experience is on tonight on Public TV.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The partisan divide got a lot of attention last week in the State of the Union address from President Obama.
I have no doubt a president with the gifts of Lincoln or Roosevelt might have better bridged the divide. And I guarantee I'll keep trying to be better so long as I hold this office. But my fellow Americans, this cannot be my task or any president's alone.
South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley also tackled the issue in her Republican response.
During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation.
Our next guest says the president and Governor Haley are right to be worried about partisan anger, and Wisconsin is no exception to that kind of divisiveness. He worries that the partisan divide is leading to a rise of cynicism among American voters, making it hard to trust politicians from the opposing party or even to trust politicians or government at all.
David Haynes joins us now. He's the editorial page editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which released an editorial on cynicism over the holiday weekend. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob and Veronica. Glad to be with you.
Well, David, what got you and the editorial board there thinking about cynicism this weekend?
Well, I think it's a combination of things, and an unlikely trio of politicians, Nikki Haley and Barack Obama, and Bob Gannon, a Republican assemblyman from Slinger, who, as we all know, made a crude gesture to the Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca last week. And it just got us to thinking about, you know, that is just so way over the top. Would that have even happened a few years ago? I'm not sure it would have. And part of what's going on here, I think, is that overall we've sort of allowed the political debate to become much coarser than it used to be. I mean, we can have a nice, calm discussion on Wisconsin Public Radio, but if you go on some of the cable news shows at night, that's not calm. And I think you see some of that bleeding into politics. You recall the congressman a few years ago who cried out, "He lies," during, I believe that was during a State of the Union address regarding President Obama. And I just thought that Nikki Haley's remarks and Obama's remarks were right spot on. There is blame on both sides. So let's sort of get past that and start talking to one another in a way that we can actually debate the issues.
Well, this is incivility among between people of the different parties. Do you see that turning off the public to politics, to politicians, to government in general?
Well, I think there's no question it does. But I think there's some other things going on, too. Craig Gilbert, our Washington bureau chief, did a really great piece this weekend where he looked at a Pew Research Center poll. It's actually the same one that was referenced in our editorial. And they asked last year, Democrats and Republicans alike, which side did they feel was winning, their side or the other side? And both of them said the other side was winning. They were both losing. And I think the era of divided government in some ways is to blame for that. And we've had divided government for many years at a national level. It leaves people feeling frustrated. Republicans clearly at the national level, that's in Wisconsin where Republicans basically call all the shots at this point, but at the national level they control the Congress, but they can't repeal Obamacare. And so they've made promises to their constituents that they can't keep. That leads to frustration. You know, and so it also leads, I think, to this phenomenon of candidates like Donald Trump and to some extent Ted Cruz, who are pretty angry out there when you listen to them on the campaign trail.
Right. I think there's one thing is to be distrustful of the person on the other side of the partisan fence. That's common. It can get out of hand. But there are a lot of people always, and maybe more now, who have the notion that all politicians are liars. All politicians aren't worthy of trust. That isn't new, but do you think it's different? Do you think it's more widespread now?
Well, I think it's deeper, and I don't have the statistics in front of me, but if you look at, I think Gallup measures this. If you look at the approval rating for Congress, I mean, it's just horrible. And they have kind of dragged each other down. And again, I think that there's many reasons for this. Gridlock in government is part of it. I think in Wisconsin, quite honestly, the Republicans have a fair amount to answer for. Governor Walker, for example, didn't campaign on Act 10, what became Act 10. He couldn't have campaigned on it because it was going to be a loser at the ballot box. But once they gained power over both houses of the legislature and the governor's office, they decided to, in their words, go big, and they did. But I think that kind of behavior, without involving the other party in a real discussion, leads to the kind of anger and cynicism that you see on the other side of the aisle.
Talking to David Haynes from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about cynicism in politics and the partisan divide and the lack of trust in government and politicians of either party very often. David, a politician, an elected official, is getting pulled both ways, though. There are people who will say, people like you, who will say, hey, to demonstrate leadership, you have to compromise. You have to work together, reach across the aisle to get things done. But for each party, to a greater or lesser extent at any given time, there is the party faithful, the party base, who view compromise as a betrayal of core principles. So how does a politician navigate that in a positive way?
Well, we've seen politicians in the past, and I'm going back a few years here, but we've seen politicians in the past put aside the politics and act like leaders. You know, even Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, who wouldn't agree on much, found a way to come together and compromise on things like welfare reform, on things like balancing the federal budget back in the 90s. And if you go further back, there was even more of a tradition of that. We're not seeing much of that at the national level, and we're certainly not seeing much involvement from the minority party at all at the state level right now. So, but I think it starts with politicians deciding to be leaders in addition to being politicians.
Now, in another piece you'd written a while back, you point to some concrete ways to work toward that. One thing you mentioned was redistricting reform as a way maybe to end some of the hyper-partisanship. Connect the dots there for us.
Yeah, I think redistricting reform is really important because what happens in the sort of districts we have now in Wisconsin and in fact in many other states around the country is that the real election occurs in the primary, not in the general election, because these districts are so far tilted in our state. Frankly, they're tilted toward the GOP because of the redistricting in 2011. In parts of Illinois, they're tilted toward the Democrats. They're so tilted in one direction that there really isn't a race in the general election. Whoever gets the nomination, let's say, in a hard right-leaning district is going to win. And so the real election occurs in the primary. Who comes out for a primary election? It's the partisans. And so it tends to pull the candidates farther one way or another, depending on which way the district is tilting. And that's how they govern once they're elected. And I think we've seen that in a number of races in Wisconsin in the state house.
to get something like redistricting reform, I don't know how you'd make that happen. The public would have to be heavily invested in that. It's not a very sexy issue. And if you've got a lot of people who are cynical and disaffected from politics, how do you get them excited about something like that? That seems abstract. That seems a little distant.
Yeah, I know. It's tough. I helped organize, along with my buddy over in Madison, Scott Milford, the editorial page editor at the State Journal. A couple of years ago, we organized, I guess you would call it, a campaign of editorial boards around the state. And we had 9 or 10 or 12 different newspapers involved. And we all decided we're not going to tell each other what to write, but on this day, let's write about it. And we did get some, we did have some impact in terms of raising awareness about it. But it's a tough issue. I mean, it's complicated. It's kind of Byzantine. It's hard for people to understand. And in a world where, you know, sound bites are more common than sometimes thoughtful thinking, it's a little hard to get through. But I think we just have to keep at it. You know, Iowa has done this for years, 30, 40 years, and it works very well down there. They have more competitive races than we do. And so that's the model that we have favored. And I think you have to get the public to put pressure on the legislators. It can happen. I mean, when we went through this thing with open records during the summer and into the fall, the public rose up and said, no, we want those records to be transparent. And the legislators who were backing secrecy, in effect, back down. So I think it can happen with redistricting reform too, but you need, again, some politicians to act like leaders, and you need the public to put pressure on them.
We're talking to David Haynes from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the partisan divide and rising cynicism in politics here in Wisconsin and around the nation.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see rising cynicism in politics? Do you feel it? And do you think one party is to blame or both parties? And what could be done to rebuild our trust in one another and in the political system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with David Haynes, editorial page editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. In a recent piece, he says he's worried about rising cynicism in American politics.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you feeling cynical about American politics, about Wisconsin politics? What is turning you off when it comes to politics? Or do you think it's important to stay involved and tuned in, even in the midst of partisan divisions? And what can be done to get political leaders working together and the electorate as a whole, maybe seeing the points that the other side is making? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Dave on the line in Kimberly. Dave, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I think it's that we've seen, even within this state, how the Republican politicians are very corrupt, taking bribes from corporations and the super rich, and then they have to do the corporations and the super rich favors, so they do whatever they're asked, and then they get more bribes, and it just keeps going back and forth and back and forth, and it just continues growing the corruption.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. David, I want to tackle that point in a couple different ways. First of all, in an older piece you'd written that big money in politics, you do see as part of the problem.
Well, I do think it's part of the problem, but I think it's also an issue that's very hard to solve given the Supreme Court decisions about money as speech. But what we would like to see happen, what I've argued for repeatedly, and our editorial board has, is transparency. If a large contributor is trying to influence an election for a particular legislator or governor, we ought to know about it. And right now, we don't always know. The dark money is a problem, and I think that also breeds the cynicism. I'd add just one other point, too. Politicians have to spend an awful lot of time raising money, and that detracts from the amount of time that they're spending on the job. David Jolly, who's a Republican congressman from the Tampa Bay area, introduced a bill today that would prevent members of Congress from actually doing their own fundraising. They'd have to outsource it. And I don't know. I haven't looked at it. I don't know how I feel about that. But I know what he's trying to get at, or at least I think what he's trying to get at, is they ought to be on the job doing their jobs.
David, thanks for that call. And another thing that Dave reminded me of, David, is a notion. I mean, he sees the Republicans as corrupt, and I think it's a common theme I encountered a lot in my line of work. I'm sure you do, too, where people assume that everyone on the other side is either corrupt or stupid or deluded or some negative thing. There's not a positive. They can't imagine a positive motivation for the other side.
Right, right. And Dave, thanks for the call, Dave. Dave used the word bribes. And, you know, they're campaign contributions. I understand why he's saying that, because there's always an assumption that that will lead to something, and sometimes it does. But there's also a lot of folks who are very civic-minded. I mean, these jobs are hard jobs in a lot of ways. You don't get paid a ton of money. And I have great respect for people who do them. We need people to step up, good people to step up and do them. But I think transparency is part of the issue. If we have a better idea of what they're getting from whom and when, then we can hold them accountable.
Back to our callers now with Ross in Twin Lakes. Ross, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say the same sort of thing about the money in politics. Mike McCabe says that we've always had bribery, but this is the first time that it's been legal. And I think that the public sees what's going on, the tremendous amount of money that's going into the campaigns. The average person doesn't have much of a chance to run for office, and I think that we have to constantly be working on that.
Ross, thanks for the call. And that's another possible source of cynicism, that idea of relative powerlessness. Ross sees it in average person not being able to make a significant donation compared to a very wealthy person. Do you see this, David, as part of a root of disaffection with politics?
Well, I think it is. I think it's a really good point that Ross raises. But you also have to keep in mind that there's nothing that says that a group of citizens can't band together for a cause. This happens all the time. And so I don't know what Ross's clause is. He may have many clauses, but you can make a bigger, you can get more bang for the buck, so to speak, by banding together or joining an organization that, you know, believes as you do and contributing to them. My only thing is I'd like to know what they're contributing and to whom.
Talking to David Haynes from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about cynicism in politics. Ross, thanks for that call. We'll go now to Marilyn in Grays Lake, Illinois. Marilyn, hi.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I am calling from Illinois because there really is, I think, a direct comparison of what's happening in Wisconsin as what's happening in Illinois. As you say, the way with gerrymandering, Wisconsin is controlled mostly by the GOP, Democrats in Illinois. The cynicism in politics is there with the legislatures, but also with the voters in both states. And I think it hinges, at least one of the things that hinge on is the idea of compromise. It really, when you see what's been happening, what's being said, compromise is not working together like they did back in the 90s, the 80s, Tip O'Neill, whatever. It is more a case of do it my way because I'm in power and you, minority, just take it. And that's why in Wisconsin, in Illinois, I feel that's why the minority is having a very tough time. Why do it? Keep trying, but why do it? Because they're just going to get overridden.
Interesting,
and we saw
Marilyn.
That in the U.S. Congress.
Interesting, Marilyn. Thanks a lot for that call, David. So people getting disaffected, getting cynical because they don't make a difference. The other side controls everything.
Yeah, you know, in Illinois, it was interesting. At the same time, the Republicans were doing a number, in my opinion, in gerrymandering Wisconsin. The Democrats in Illinois did much the same thing. Bob Dole, the moderate Republican, who's back in office now, was gerrymandered out of his seat in northern Illinois. And so no party has the hands of neither party is clean on that particular issue.
Marilyn, thanks a lot for that call. So how do we get out of this, David? I mean, the temptation now is if your party's in power in Illinois and Wisconsin, in Congress, you name it, you don't want to compromise. You want to take the ball and run with it. How do we switch that mentality to, hey, let's see where we can work together?
Well, one, I think, again, it takes leadership. It takes some brave individuals to stand up and say we're going to do it a different way. I don't know if Congressman Jolly's bill is, the right way to do it, but I know that Tim Cullen, a Democrat, and Dale Schultz, a Republican, when they were in office in Wisconsin, tried very hard to get some redistricting reform through the legislature, and they didn't make it. But you have to keep trying. And I think citizens have to let their representatives know that we want something better. We want something different. And I think all of us, frankly, and me included, I thought Nikki Haley's speech the other night really, really hit home for me. All of us have to sort of look in our own hearts and say, are we being civil here? Are we having a real discussion, or is it just shouting? And I think we all have to look in the mirror sometimes.
When it comes to that incivility and the shouting, I think people are very ready to police and promote good behavior for the other side. Do you think people need to do more of what you mentioned Nikki Haley did and police their own side, step up and critique their own people when they're incivil or angry or whatever?
Well, no, I think there's no doubt about it, and that's what made her speech the other night so powerful. Now, understand, she has like 80% favorability in her state right now and like 85% among the Tea Party members in her state. So she's no rhino. I mean, she is a very conservative politician. Mm-hmm. But she's also been changed while in office, in part by what happened down in Charleston last year. And I thought the way she handled that and subsequently the way she led the fight to take down the flag on the Capitol grounds there, the Confederate flag, showed real leadership. And so you have to have people like her stand up and do the right thing.
David, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
You bet. Glad to be with you.
We've been talking to David Haynes. He's the editorial page editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Happy 70th birthday today to Dolly Parton, the legendary country music singer and pop singer and songwriter and actress and theme park owner.
Parton was born on this day in 1946 in Tennessee, and she's put out over 50 albums throughout her career with dozens of singles, making their way over into the top 40 country charts and a lot of crossover hits, too.
Her best-known movie appearances include Steel Magnolias, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and 9 to 5. Her song, the title song for that movie, was a number one single in the U.S. Veronica, you're a big fan of Dolly Parton as a singer, and you're a singer yourself, so this is a voice you admire.
Yeah, she goes way back for me. Yeah, I remember buying a vinyl album of hers. I think she had on like a red gingham shirt or something and cutoffs when I was a kid in Illinois, and I remember just playing that record. I just had never heard a voice like that. And whether or not you like country music, mm-hmm. whether you like rap music, I just think Dolly Parton's voice is one you're never going to hear again in a lifetime.
Unique, a very unique voice.
Right, and you're a singer. Do you like her? Does she cross over for you?
Let's put singer in quotes first.
A musician.
So I don't claim to know her catalog swirl and over 50 albums. I mean, you'd have to be really into it to know it all. But yes, she's got a great voice and a lot of great music out there.
All right, well, we're going to go out with this one from her, from her Bluegrass album, The Grass is Blue. This is a song, I'm Going to Sleep With When I Open.
I just found out today. So